4. Palestinians don't have a place to go. In this edition of the program, we will look at this genocide, which has just passed the 200-day mark, and examine how Israel may be stuck in a quagmire, failing militarily in this genocide. First, let me introduce our guests. Barbara Fantina, author and journalist, joins us from Kitchener. Also joining us is Fahima Mahomet, broadcaster and TV presenter from London. I'd like to welcome both of our guests, and I'll first start with you, Robert Fantina. So we are looking at an announcement that now has been made. It was just made a couple hours back. Israel has said that it's going to move ahead with this attack on Rafah, and we're looking, obviously, at what that may entail. Now, what's interesting about what they have said, first to get your reaction, is that we are going to work to spare Palestinian civilians there, the lives of Palestinian civilians. And the question comes about, why should we believe the Israeli regime when it says that it's going to work to do that when it hasn't done that in the past?
There is no reason to believe the Israeli regime. They have no intention of protecting the Palestinians. They have no desire to do so. They are trying to tell people to go to Al-Mawasi, which is a place that is ill-equipped to handle even the people who are there now. And people who are in the southern part of Gaza have no way of getting there, transporting themselves, their families, their any possessions they might still have, of getting there. Now, also have to remember that Israel is saying it's going to work to protect civilians, but it considers any male over the age of 18 to be a, quote, terrorist. So they can just slaughter people indiscriminately and call them all terrorists. That's what they've been doing for the last 200 days. That's what they will continue to do. They have no regard for the human lives of the Palestinian people. They don't consider them humans, and they're treating them as such. What we're going to see if they do proceed with this invasion of Rafah is going to be a horrific bloodbath and slaughter that will make the last 200 days that will exceed the horror of the last 200 days.
All right, Fahima, I'd also like to get your reaction on this, but in particular, when you take a look at some of the details, it is said that they're going to be moving population to the nearby city of Khan Yunis over a period of 2 to 3 weeks. That's one of the things they have said. It will then send troops into Rafah gradually, targeting areas where they claim that leaders of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas are residing in. The question then comes about, this means that any chance of a ceasefire agreement now is gone, that might as well kiss that goodbye, along with the possibility of the captives at this point in terms of any push for the Israeli regime to save them.
Absolutely, and I do agree with our guest as well, the fact that any sort of attack right now would be an absolute horror, especially with the given amount of over a million people gathered in that one particular area. And even if they were to move, we've just heard even recently that there's been mass graves in the area of Khan Yunis and others, and it's been reported that there is nowhere safe. And we cannot even guarantee that they are going to be moved safely in the time that Israel says that they are going to actually bombard that particular area in Rafah particularly. Also, it is an actual target and security alarm for even Egypt, as it is going to be quite close to their borders. And normally they do actually take sort of preempt planned sort of attacks whereby employing measures such as border patrols and surveillances and intelligence gathering and counterterrorism operations to mitigate security risks and maintain stability in the region. But now all of those things seems to be completely out of any sort of security, and they're violating any kind of security, as well as in the situation right now where there are absolutely no reason why Israel, that they, whatever they say, is going to actually remain where we can actually believe them. And we can't even see what the situation is in Palestine at the moment, in any area, because they still deny the journalists from outside to come in to report. And anything that Israel says is taken on board. So we have absolutely no clue as to what really is going on, how many people, maybe only decades later, we're going to find out with regards to the numbers. And even what we know right now is probably going to be more than quadrupled than what we even know at this very moment in time, unfortunately.
Indeed. It's very interesting. We're looking at Robert Fantina, this package of military aid that the U.S. approved going to Ukraine, and then you have some going to Israel to the tune of $26 billion. When this was signed, the ink wasn't dry, and you had the U.S. President Joe Biden say, we're going to be sending missiles, along amongst other things, to Ukraine within hours. That was his thing. Now, we're looking at just the past couple hours where Israel has made this statement that it's going to invade Rafah. Do you get the feeling that this is just a coincidence, or that Israel was waiting for this to get approved, military equipment to be sent, and maybe serve as at least a basis for the what seems to be an imminent invasion of Rafah?
Israel has delayed the invasion. They've been saying for several weeks that they're going to invade Rafah. It's just a matter of when. But now they have the weaponry to do it in a very, what they would consider a very effective way, killing tens of thousands of innocent people. And perhaps they didn't have all that weaponry before because they had used it on the first 34 or 35,000 Palestinians that they'd killed. It's also so hypocritical that the United States is sending aid to Ukraine and not to Gaza, when what Israel is doing to Gaza is astronomically more serious than what's happening in Ukraine. And yet Ukraine is getting all kinds of support, but for the Palestinians, the support the United States is sending is being sent to the perpetrator rather than to the victims. So I do think, yes, that this is timed to coincide with receiving this weaponry from the United States.
When our guest there, Robert Fantina, when he was looking for the words as to what Israel was doing to the Gaza Strip, it's pretty much the reaction that many around the world not only have been having, but also had when they heard about these mass graves that were unveiled, not only in terms of the Al-Shifa Hospital, but also the Nasser Medical Complex, where another, I think, 20 or 30 bodies. Amongst the three massacres that involved hospitals, you remember the Al-Ahli one that was 500 plus, and Al-Shifa that are roughly amounted to about 400. And then you have the UN coming out, I guess the UN official that came out and said, we have to launch an investigation. What does that mean, launching an investigation? What do they need to see? I mean, there have been sightings of people who were blindfolded and executed, amongst them women and children.
Yes, there were reports to actually suggest that when those mass graves were actually investigated, they did find that the bodies were so there's no words for it, but you cannot actually identify them. But they were in a state where they were actually... arms were actually, tied up. So they were in a state where they weren't even, probably given the kind of right to actually even defend themselves or be, properly given that sort of state where they were under trial if they were supposedly, as the Israelis say, either sort of like militants or militia or anything like that. So we would never really know. And the thing is, it is such a heightened conflict right now that even if you were to move anyone, right now they're not giving the aid for them where it cannot be reached. So to move them even further, which we know at that moment in time it's not reaching there, which is even harder, how are they even going to survive if they are going to move them further, back to another sort of place? So it doesn't make sense as to what they're doing, and they seem to believe everything that Israel is saying and just making up excuses, and it doesn't seem to make any sense to anyone outside. That's why we're getting such an uproar even from the universities in the USA, and it's just now where everyone is not believing. And we also see the disruption that's happening in Tel Aviv itself against Netanyahu. But even though we have so many of their own people that are, fed up of what's going on, and they want, to see much better sort of outcomes as to what's happening, we do need to realize that with the backing and the ally that Israel has, there is unfortunately going to continue with this destruction and this genocide and this continuous mass sort of murdering without consequences. Because as we know from the Iraq war, when, even up till now, we're waiting for even international courts to even deem that to be sort of illegal. So this, again, is going to be something that unfortunately does not look like they will actually be held account.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
There have been mass movements on this in the form of protests, but in particular, our guest there touched on it, Robert Fantina, and those are student protests that we've seen erupt on college campuses. And it's quite interesting that you're having these Ivy League colleges actually be the ones that seem to be headlining it, you know, like Columbia or Harvard or Brown or Yale. And what's more interesting about this is that this has been going on for quite some time, actually. It broke out when the Operation Al-Aqsa flood broke out. There were these protests. But this time I think it's different. First of all, you're looking at encampments, you know, these tents that are set up. It kind of reminds us of Zuccotti Park, if you remember, back in the Wall Street protests back then. But what do you think of these student protests? They want basically, they're looking at a boycott type in terms of their charter, if you want to call it that, that they should cut ties with companies that make money that goes to Israel. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, many of these universities have financial ties with Israel, and the students are demanding, among other things, that those ties be cut because they violate the university's charters and their standards of human rights, and they want nothing to do with it. They don't want to benefit from any monies coming from Israel. They're also demanding a ceasefire, and the school administrators are not listening to them. Therefore, they've taken to these actions of these encampments, which are peaceful. They're legal because these are students, at least most of them. Some non-students have come onto campus occasionally, but most of them are students who are camping on university property. They're paying tuition to go there, and they have the right to be there. And these are expanding, as you mentioned, across the country. They're going to continue to expand. The school year is ending in just a few weeks for most of the students, but this isn't going to come to a close then. These students will be involved in Youth for Palestine movements in their communities, and then thanks to social media, they will be in contact with each other and with countless others who feel that they the way they do. They'll continue to work for justice for the Palestinians. That's what we're seeing now. It's a wonderful movement to see. It needs to expand. It needs to continue.
Yeah, and you know, one of the events that happened here, I don't know if you recall, it was back in November of last year, where there was the largest pro-Palestine protest in the U.S., where the destination was the White House. And I think there was over 250 groups that were involved. This was a mass mobilization, the biggest one that the U.S. has witnessed. If you combine that with the student protests that are taking place, do you agree with what one analyst said, that, you know, this is the younger generation? They don't think of Israel the way that the older generation did. It's a new ball game now, and they do not want the support that the U.S. is giving them, mainly due to the genocide taking place, but in particular because of the way they've treated Palestinians. Do you agree?
Absolutely, and that's why there's been the ban that has been approved for TikTok, because they know that how widespread social media is to actually get information out there. But regardless of that, we can now thank social media and sort of the digital platforms outside the mainstream and the propaganda media on the mainstream sort of channels. So people are much more aware of actually what's happening. And what amazingly has come out of this is that everyone has actually learned the true history and destruction destruction over decades of what's been happening as Israel being the oppressor, the apartheid, and all of so many illegal, inhumane things that they have been getting away with for so many decades, that now people are totally awakened by this. And the new generation and the current generation is definitely not going to be quiet about this, because it affects their future, it affects their lives, and it affects their children. And, you know, that old mindset, and even the most powerful, maybe lobbyist groups, are really terrified, because when they speak and when they erupt as young as they are, it makes a difference to the future. So I think it's really powerful. It needs to continue. And even if these voices may not actually, you know, go into making differences in policies, but the fact that it's causing the disruption that it has, where the entire, even certain universities, have now actually stopped learning in the campus and actually going online, shows that it does, you know, make and serve some sort of movement to say that if we're not heard, then we are going to cause this disruption and cause some sort of discourse where we need to be seen and heard according to their normal human rights, because we're speaking up for the voiceless. And again, they're not going to accept the general and the normal rhetoric and narrative that has always been.
Well, talk about change. And this was something that was really, I don't know, it was really shocking to hear. And it was in the form of the U.S. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer. I don't know if you remember that, Robert Fantina, where he came out and he said, "I worry under his leadership, in reference to Netanyahu, Israel will become a pariah in the world, and even in the U.S. Without American support, Israel's future could well be over." I mean, this kind of goes with the theme of our program tonight, where Israel is not only stuck in a quagmire, but the U.S. is helping it, and it's still stuck. But the point of view, the stance that he has, you could never imagine that. I don't think you're in the States there, Robert. Something that U.S. politicians would say years ago, even, what Chuck Schumer said.
Yes, it was. It would have been unheard of just a few years ago. Everything, the House of Representatives and the Senate walked lockstep in concert with whatever Israel wanted. Whatever it wanted, it got in terms of money. It could do no wrong. Israel was a sort of god to the United States. But as Schumer said, that Israel risks becoming a pariah state. Israel is a pariah state on the international stage. It was certainly an outlier prior to October 7th. But since this genocide has started, we've seen people around the world in massive, massive demonstrations against Israel, against the Israeli government. These are not anti-Semitic in any means. Criticism of Israel is not criticism of Jewish people or Jewishness. But we are seeing that the nation of Israel is a pariah on the world stage, as Schumer predicted. And it's not going to change unless the Israeli government changed its policies, which would be drastic, and there is no indication that's going to happen now. Netanyahu has said there will never be an independent Palestine on his watch. Biden vetoed the admission of Palestine into the United Nations as a full member just a week or so ago. So the United States and Israel are both pariah states, and they are showing that more and more as this genocide continues.
You know, when you take a look at Israel in terms of any achievements here, what are we looking at, Fahima? I mean, it's been 201 day at this point since Operation Al-Aqsa flood. There hasn't been any achievements on the ground in terms of the two ideals that they were after, goals, elimination of Hamas and the return of captives, except for the ceasefire that took place. And now they're looking at going after Rafah and invade there. They're saying that there are going to be Hamas leaders there. What if that fails, which then points to even a darker, perhaps, plan that they have, that this is all just a cover for trying to oust Palestinians from their homeland?
That's exactly that. And maybe we might not see it as a sort of like a success story with regards to the Israeli point of view, with them actually achieving anything. But actually, they've destroyed the entire strip of Gaza. So at the end of the day, unfortunately, it is something that they have actually achieved, which is why they wanted that space for themselves. So even if people wanted to go back, they have no means of actually rebuilding again. So it would be up to them to actually take over. However, they sort of, you know, put it into their own story as whether or not they're helping to rebuild or again, putting on their own sort of like settlements like they have in the West Bank. And now they have complete control because they've actually destroyed everything. So it's not even inhabitable. So at the end of the day, we have to basically understand that regardless of what we see on the mainstream, there's definitely an agenda for them to actually take over. And they've actually done that. And there have been plans even before the 7th of October, which they have actually come across where research has been said that, you know, they wanted to strip down that entire area, have so much built on it, you know, have the gases that, you know, is from there. So there has been plans way before this, regardless if it was for that particular moment in time where it happened from October the 7th, but there's definitely been an idea where they need to take over that for themselves because of what lies underneath. So it may not be the success as in getting those hostages back from the rest of the world, and that's what it is, but they've definitely succeeded, unfortunately, in displacement, in breaking and destruction of the entire region, and where even if they were to come back, they've got nothing to come back to, and they've got no one fighting for the Palestinians around, even in the Arab world, to actually even give them any support, even with just the basic aid. So unfortunately, if it's not even them pulling back, they have the problems of, you know, famine and so many other things that's going to come along with that.
Indeed. Well, I mean, you take a look at some Israeli officials, statements that they have made, Robert Fentina, the former major general, Yitzhak Brick. Israel has lost his he calls it a war. We call it a genocidal war against Hamas in the Gaza Strip. You have the Israeli intel minister, days ago, he resigned. And you're having many analysts say that Israel has already lost strategically and operationally, which then puts into question what is their motive behind continuing with this genocide, and also put into question the U.S. military assistance given to Israel.
The motive is the destruction of the Palestinian people. Israel wants all of Palestine, wants to annex the entirety of Palestine. And the way it can do that is by killing them all or driving them into refugee camps in another country. The stated goals of defeating Hamas and releasing the prisoners. Well, the first one, you can't defeat an ideology. The people of Palestine, Gaza, West Bank, and everywhere else are going to continue to be opposed to the occupation, the brutal, repressive occupation, no matter whether that resistance is called Hamas or anything else. So that's not going to be defeated until there is a just solution to this horrific occupation. And as far as releasing the prisoners, if the Israeli government had been reasonable, and thinking of the Israeli government as ever being reasonable is just preposterous. But had it been reasonable, it could have established a ceasefire, a permanent ceasefire, which would have released all the hostages at that time. But that's not what Israel's interested. It's not interested in really defeating Hamas. It's not interested in getting back the hostages. It's interested in killing or expelling all the Palestinians and then taking complete control and annexing the Gaza Strip.
All right, I heard a timer there, and coincidentally, we're out of time ourselves here. So thank you for that. Robert Fentina, author and journalist from Kitchener. Thank you, Fahima Mohammed, broadcaster and TV presenter from London. Thank you to you both. With that, we come to end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mikova Tawe and the team, it's goodbye.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma. Once more, I have the honor to be your host in today's episode. And, of course, like always, we have two very dear guests. Assalamu alaikum, Brother Muzaffar, and assalamu alaikum, Sister Nahid.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
And as the ritual of this program goes, I would like you to introduce yourself briefly.
First of all, salam alaikum to you and all your dear listeners. Well, I'm Nahid. I'm a graduate of TFO, and I've been studying and researching on Muslim issues, and especially Muslim women issues. And I'm so glad and honored to be here with you.
Yeah, so good. And you, brother?
I am Muzaffar Haider from the UK. I've been studying in the Hawza for the past 10 years in the holy city of Qom.
I wish both of you luck and success. God is very kind and so merciful, full of mercy towards us. Does he need my appreciation? Why do I have to worship? Like, we hear this question a lot from today's generation. Like, they keep saying that, okay, if God is that kind, if he loves me with no condition, then why do I have to go for praying? Why do I have to devote a special time for worship? Why?
No, that's a really good question. But first, can I bring the topic of why do we appreciate, even people, why do we appreciate them? Sometimes we appreciate for gratitude, for just for the sake of appreciating the other person's favor for us.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we appreciate as a technique of receiving more.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
You do something good to me, I appreciate. And then
you're trading.
It's because I'm tricking you over this, and I want you to do something more for
mm-hmm.
me. And sometimes, no, it's a technique for me to stay in the society, to follow the rules of morality, and to be a logical person who knows the thing that whatever you get, you need the whatever blessing you get, if it's about Allah, or whatever blessing you get, you need to appreciate for it. And there are too many reasons. Like, they are not necessarily about religion, they're not necessarily about Islam, it's about the God, the one who Allah, who made us, who created us. And we need to understand, he doesn't need it, we are the people who need this appreciation for our own sake, for our improvement as human beings.
Now I come to ask then, why do I need it?
As a human being?
Yeah.
What is your purpose of life? Not you. I mean, what is the purpose of a human being?
What is the purpose of your life, sister? Studying for exams.
No.
Sleeping 2 hours a day.
One of our purposes is
hosting
to
this show. Sorry.
One of our purposes is to achieve self-growth.
Yeah.
If you want to improve, you need to know the norms, the way, the techniques.
Mm-hmm.
The techniques through achieving the life purpose are defined. You should know the norms. We should know the laws and the rules. And if you want to achieve that level of self-improvement and self-growth, you need to know the way. And this process, appreciation, is a technique, is a tool, is a device that is there for us,
mm-hmm.
for our improvement.
So, God has created me
mm-hmm.
and brought me into this world. I know that for my betterment, for my improvement, I need to worship him.
Mm-hmm.
I need someone to resort to. And
mm-hmm.
who is going to be better than the one who created me?
Yeah.
So I have to appreciate him. In what ways can I appreciate whatever he has done to me?
Well, firstly, going off the back of what Sister was saying, there's a hadith that says that one who has not thanked the creation has not thanked the creator,
yeah.
right? So in order to worship
Allah... Like the other
Allah,
people.
Yeah. In order to worship Allah, and this is a bit of a profound thing I'm about to say, so bear with me. In order to worship Allah, you have to serve the creation to a lesser or greater extent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Allah likes it when we are good to other people, when we're kind to other people, when we appreciate other people, especially those who have done the most for us. For example, your parents.
Parents.
Why does Allah yeah. say so much in the Quran and in the Ahadith about parents, parents, parents? Because it is so easy to overlook the fact that your parents literally raised you. I wouldn't have raised you. Like your boss, for example, or your teacher, you give them so much appreciation because you're old and mature enough to recognize that this person is doing a favor to me. But these guys raised you when you were a nasty little baby and you used to poop your pants and you just had no, like, you just had no use except
exactly.
for eating all
good
of our
good for nothing.
Yeah. Right? They did that. Appreciation of them is appreciation of God. There was also a hadith from Prophet Musa alayhi salam. As you know, he's one of the great prophets of Allah, and he is known as the one who spoke to Allah. All the prophets pretty much spoke to Allah and were spoken to. But Musa alayhi salam is very unique because he used to have these special conversations with God. He used to ask questions that most of us wouldn't dare to ask. And most of us would think are silly questions that children would ask. Musa alayhi salam had the courage to ask them. And one of the things that he asked Allah is, "Oh Allah, what would you do if you were the creation?" Isn't that a really
nice question?
Yeah. We would ask that when we were kids, right? That's something you would ask your parents, and your parents would be like, "Blasphemy! How dare you?" You know? No, he asked this question. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, "Ya Musa, I would serve the creation." That is a really, for me personally, that was really life-changing hadith.
Yeah.
Because it gives you a direction. Look, I'm here amongst these other creatures. What's the best thing that I can do for everybody?
So helping other people is a way of showing my gratitude and my appreciation.
Sister, you're only here for a few moments, right? And then after this, you're going to go to your grave. You're going to be alone.
Yeah.
And inshallah, when you go to Jannah and everything else, you're going to have lots of people and a great social life, inshallah. But there is going to be a long, long, long moment which is completely alone. And at the end of the day, when you're sleeping, when you're in the bathroom, you are on your own.
Exactly.
You are a very lonely creature. And, you know, in night, you're going to be alone as well, inshallah. Mm-hmm. You have those solitary moments with your Lord, speaking to him in the night. You know.
Generally speaking, we're lonely travelers.
Yeah, generally. But
no matter how many people are there around us.
Yeah, it's just a very temporary thing, if you think about it.
Yeah.
You're going to spend some time with some people. What's the best thing that you can do with them? How can you maybe help them in some way?
So that was very nice. But I guess right now we have to go for a change of mood and then we'll be back. Following what you were just saying, there was a piece of a literary piece that I loved so much, and it said that in the end of the life, we're not going to be judged by the number of houses we got, or cars we bought, or documents that we have, certifications that we're going to get. We're going to be judged by the amount of humanity we shared with other people. Mm-hmm. The much of poverty that I tried to overcome, that I tried to help people to overcome, the much of broken hearts that I helped to mend themselves, and stuff like this. So you were just saying that helping other people, serving the creation of Allah, is going to be a way of showing my appreciation to God's blessings, to whatever blessing God has given to me.
See, my wife is really, God bless her, she's really giving. Almost too giving. It gets on my nerves sometimes because she's always saying, "Oh, this neighbor
so
needs this,"
kind,
or, you know, "Those talibah over there, let's give this."
Women
to them.
Are just so kind.
God bless you.
Yeah.
Guys, you know?
Without us, you would have had this solid, stony,
true
world.
Yeah. They have
with
this,
no colors, no emotions.
They provide a lot of balance. Alhamdulillah. But anyway, there's a hadith of the Prophet where he had some meat and he cut off a portion of it and he said, "Give this to so-and-so person," mm-hmm. "or to a neighbor." And his wife said, "Oh, you know, we've given that away and we were only left with this much." The Prophet said, "Actually, it's the opposite.
Exactly.
That which we've given away is with us for eternity. That which we are now about to eat is just going to be consumed and it's going to disappear."
Sister Nahid,
and this aspect is really important and needs to be taken into account, that Allah Himself is self-sufficient. He doesn't need our gratitude.
Of course.
And the reason He's kind of advising us to be grateful is as a means of our own self-improvement and the benefits for us. He wants us to have a beneficial life. That's why He has advised us towards gratitude and appreciation. It's like we are appreciating Him. We are following His order because He has also ordered to appreciate Him as the Lord, besides even appreciating the world around us, besides appreciating the creation, he has advised us to appreciate. And the reason is not like that. He wants us as the creations. He doesn't want us to just say, thank you for making me. Thank you for giving me everything. He doesn't want to hear these words. The reason is for him to... The reason is that he's so kind that he wants us to be more benefited, be blessed.
Actually, I always think of, out of all of these things that we experience in this world with all the difficulties and problems, there is something that is very clear. Even at the moment that you feel like you're so lonely, you can feel there is something. There is someone who's over there watching you. There's someone who cares too much for you. And I guess the idea behind him asking us to worship him is not just a matter of expecting him to reward us. It's not just that story. It's more of a love story.
Yeah,
I guess
it's a relationship.
The love and the bond, yes. That is the most important thing to come out of all of those worships.
Exactly. That rapport is just leading us towards our life. That rapport is building our life. Through achieving the best thing possible, through achieving the correct relationship with the Creator.
Yeah, exactly. So out of these gratitudes and appreciations, we're going to gain a sort of connection, a bond, and a love that is never ending. And in that case, if you face too many problems, if you turn into a sailor at the just very middle of an ocean that is so stormy, then you're not going to care about anything except that you have the strongest, the almighty person with you, and you do not care for anything to come. So the whole idea of worship and appreciation and gratitude is to make us have a stronger feeling of love toward the one who created us, because this love is going to save us from all the miseries that we're going to suffer in this world.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Well, with my children, I always tell them to say thank you. My children are really young, right? They're under the age of 6. And I always tell them to say thank you when I give them something. It's not because I want to hear them saying thank you or because their thank you means anything to me. It's because I know that that's really important for their upbringing. And if they don't learn that from this age, they're just going to turn into these weird, selfish people.
And they don't forget that in all the cases.
I have to remind them, right? I have to remind them. Look, I have to go, mommy, mommy, so what do you say to mommy? And then they say thank you, right? The Holy Quran says, "Inna hadaynahu sabil, imma shakiran wa imma kafura." We've guided him to the path. He may be thankful or he may be kafura. He may be unthankful.
So we must teach ourselves, actually, to be grateful.
Yeah, so I want you to visualize a person, right? Two people, and they're each given an apple, okay? The first guy, he eats his apple. He doesn't say bismillah or anything. He just eats it and he chucks it, and he leaves a lot of it as well. The second one, he first looks at the apple. He appreciates the color of the apple. He smells the apple. Then he takes his first bite. He savors it. It takes him, like, a long time to finish this apple, but when he finishes it, he's so happy and grateful in his heart. Which one enjoyed the apple?
The second one, of course.
The second one. Why? This is one of the... Look, you cannot be obedient to Allah except that you will be rewarded through it.
I guess that we have to nurture ourselves, to teach ourselves to be grateful people for whatever that other people do to us and for whatever blessing that God gives us. And this is very important, to not take things for granted, like anything that happens to you, it must have happened to you. No, it has been just a blessing given to you, and you should know the value and the worth of that thing. So this was all the time, and I hope you enjoyed it. Until another session, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya رب العالمين, Ya رحمن Ya رحيم, Ya ربي. let the ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again, let us see daylight again, once again.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
During the second day of his official visit, the Iranian president displayed a keen focus on strengthening cultural bonds with Pakistan. Traveling to Lahore, a city with rich cultural heritage, President Raisi was warmly welcomed upon his arrival by the Chief Minister of Punjab, Maryam Nawaz. He paid homage at the mausoleum of the revered Urdu and Persian poet Allama Muhammad Iqbal. Iqbal is held high esteem in Iran for his poetic works in the Persian language and is lovingly called Iqbal-e-Lahori by the Iranians. President Raisi emphasized that there was no sense of foreignness in Pakistan, underlining the deep historical and cultural connections between the two nations. President Raisi offered special prayers for the oppressed people of Gaza and lauded the Pakistani nation for its unwavering unity in championing the rights of oppressed people of Palestine. Meanwhile, the president paid a visit to the renowned University of Lahore and delivered a speech. In his address, President Raisi emphasized the deep historical, religious, cultural, and civilizational bonds between Pakistan and Iran. Raisi also said the common point of view of the people of Iran and Pakistan is the defense of the oppressed Palestinian nation. He asserted that the Islamic Republic will continue to defend the resistance and oppressed nation of Palestine with pride. President Raisi also warned that if Israel makes a mistake and attacks Iran's territory, it is clear that nothing will be left of the Israeli regime. Later, during consecutive meetings with the Chief Minister and Governor of Punjab, the Iranian President reassured Pakistani authorities of Tehran's commitment to collaborating in bolstering cultural and trade relations between the two nations.
President Raisi has devoted his second day of Pakistan visit to exploring the country's rich cultural heritage. Many believe that the Iranian President's trip will significantly contribute to boosting the bilateral trade and strengthening cultural relations between the two nations. Nasir Kazmi, Lahore.
Dozens of organizations marched in Paris against Islamophobia and racism as Israel's attempted genocide and ethnic cleansing has caused increased state-sponsored repression against Europe's largest Muslim community. A main theme of the march was protecting children. Since October 7th, children as young as 10 years old have been charged with so-called apology for terrorism, while a child of 8 was falsely targeted for praying during recess. Scandals like those have many saying that non-white children are no longer being treated like children, but instead like suspected fanatics, delinquents, and full-grown adults.
We Muslims are enduring so much Islamophobia these days, and it's not like there wasn't a lot of Islamophobia in France already. The targeting of our children is a step too far, and it's incredible that they have taken this shameful step.
As France is accused of targeting Muslim children at home, their elite are giving military and political cover to Israel's mass murder in Gaza of an estimated 15,000 children and the orphaning of some 20,000 others.
On les bombarde.
It's totally unjust how we are watching murder, torture, and the bombing of embassies, and nobody is allowed to say anything. We're here to say, stop the violence against Palestinian and Iranian people.
A decade ago, during another Israeli invasion of Gaza, France became the first country to ever ban pro-Palestinian demonstrations. They banned pro-Palestinian demonstrations for a month after the counterattack by Hamas on October 7th, handing out hundreds of thousands of euros in fines and making mass arrests. Police initially banned this march, claiming it was a threat to public order and possibly anti-Semitic. That was overturned at the last moment, but many say the effort is proof of a long-running double standard against non-whites and non-Jews.
C'est des antisémites. Ça, c'est n'importe quoi.
Anytime there is a march about Palestine or Islamophobia, the interior minister in whatever administration seeks to ban it. The idea that we are anti-Semitic is total nonsense. I get the feeling that I'm more French than many others who aren't of Algerian descent as I am, because many have totally abandoned the longtime values of French political culture.
Similar to during France's two-year state of emergency starting in November 2015, many have been shocked by the lack of outcry at this latest targeting of the Muslim community, despite perpetual bragging of being the alleged birthplace of human rights. Rami Mazahiri, Paris.
After almost 3 days, the Israeli forces withdrew from the refugee camp of Nur Shams near the city of Tul Karim in northern occupied West Bank. Only then paramedics were able to evacuate the martyrs' bodies and the families were able to count their dead. Over a dozen Palestinians have been killed since Thursday, but the number might be higher, as reports suggest that Israeli forces had confiscated the bodies of more martyrs. On Sunday, a comprehensive general strike was declared across the occupied West Bank to mourn Tul Karim martyrs. Scores of Palestinians also held a protest in the center of Ramallah against Israel's escalation and violence in Tul Karim and Nur Shams refugee camp.
Israel is expanding its genocide into the West Bank as well. And as we said before, there is no safe place for any Palestinian. And there has to be immediate Palestinian unity to stand up to this terrible aggression. And there has to be international boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign worldwide. And there has to be condemnation.
It's obvious that the Palestinian people, leadership and factions have to declare an immediate comprehensive popular uprising all over the Palestinian territories until the Israeli occupation ends. The ongoing war of attrition is no longer useful, but what's necessary is a national popular uprising.
The Israeli invasion has caused some of the worst destruction in the West Bank in decades. The occupation forces destroyed infrastructure, including sewage lines, shops, homes, and vehicles. Homes were turned into interrogation centers, and dozens of Palestinians were arrested. According to locals, heavy exchange of fire and clashes took place between resistance fighters and Israeli soldiers during the operation. The Israeli military admitted that at least 9 of its soldiers were wounded.
The Israeli occupation regime is escalating its violence against the Palestinian people. Its crimes are meant to exterminate the Palestinian people. In Gaza, genocide is being committed, and here in the West Bank, there are daily incursions, murders, collective punishment, and destruction everywhere. The Israeli occupation is doing its utmost to either bring Palestinians to their knees or commit more aggression and crimes against them.
Sunday's general strike paralyzed all aspects of life in the West Bank, with shops, schools, universities, and banks shuttered. But Palestinians question whether such a standstill is enough, expressing fear that once the Israeli military is done with Gaza, the occupied West Bank could be next. The Israeli military's violence against Palestinians is aimed at countering resistance, people here say. This is part of the Israeli crackdown on armed groups in the occupied West Bank. However, Palestinians say the Israeli crimes, including in the Nur Shams refugee camp, have failed to weaken their determination. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
A two-day international forum dubbed What Future for Palestine kicked off in Rome on Saturday. The initiative, organized by an opposition group called Front of Dissent, has been put together to tackle different topics, namely Zionism, its impact on Palestine and West Asia, the nature of Israel, what changes for the Palestinian resistance after October 7, West Asia in its transition to a multipolar world, and the risk of the Ukraine war escalating into a global conflict. The conference was attended by citizens who are very concerned about the turn the situation has taken in Western countries.
Today's forum is an important attempt to break down the wall of silence surrounding Zionist wrongdoings in West Asia. It is appalling how our mainstream media are covering Israel's brutal war in Gaza. They have created a parallel world and a parallel truth with the aim of covering up the bad things Israel is doing.
The superpowers that support Zionism are former colonial powers, most of them. And they had a role in creating Zionism in the first place. Many people allowed the Zionists to really empower themselves. So they were originally empowered by people who probably had a sense of guilt about the Holocaust, but eventually they became so powerful that they are able to control so many media outlets. They are able to control many politicians.
Speakers at the conference included former diplomats, politicians, journalists and activists from several countries, including China, the US, Britain, Russia and many others. Video links were also established with the spokesman for the worldwide anti-Zionist religious group, Neturei Karta International. Analysts at the conference are saying that the aftershocks of the Gaza crisis triggered by Israeli genocidal war are highly likely to reach far beyond West Asia and the Africa region. With the US credibility as a regional security guarantor shot to pieces, West Asia might see increased diplomatic engagement from China and Russia.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan received the head of the Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, in Istanbul. During the meeting that lasted for more than 2.5 hours, the two sides discussed the Israeli aggression on Gaza, ways and measures to ensure uninterrupted and sufficient delivery of humanitarian aid to Gaza, and the lasting peace in the West Asia region. During the meeting, President Erdogan stated that amid ongoing tensions in the region, it is important to keep the world's attention on Gaza and not allow the Israeli regime to achieve political gains from its standoff with Iran. In a statement published by the Turkish presidency, Erdogan said, "It is vital that Palestinians act with unity in this process. The strongest response to Israel and the path to victory lie in unity and integrity."
Today's meeting was very important for both Turkey and Hamas to set ground for the upcoming changes. We all know now Qatar is hosting Hamas Bureau and leaders as well as playing the role of mediator in negotiations with Israel. While there is a pressure from Washington for Hamas to leave Qatar, and there is the question of where will Hamas go now, we know that the relation of Hamas and Syria is getting better, and it already has a good relation with Iran. But I don't think they are a choice, and for that, Turkey will be the best option.
Analysts say Turkey will not only be hosting Hamas movement leaders and bureau, but will also take the lead in mediating to reach a lasting solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict.
Turkey is trying to play a very important role that is bigger than working on reaching a ceasefire in Gaza. It is rather solving the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and trying to reach a lasting solution. The 7th of October was a turning point to start working on reaching a lasting solution, and I think Turkey's role is a key for it to maintain good relations with all sides.
Hamas had an office in Turkey since 2011, and Turkey mediated in exchange of prisoners. Turkish president maintains warm relations with Haniyeh and says he will always defend the Palestinian cause. Today's meeting takes place against the backdrop of Qatar potentially stepping back from ceasefire talks. This development could create a vacancy that Ankara is well positioned to fill, given Turkey's established relations, particularly with the Hamas movement, which many view as a strategic advantage. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
According to the Palestinian Ministry of Health, more than 70% of the fatalities of the brutal Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip are children and women. Likewise, according to reports issued by the Euro-Mediterranean Center for Human Rights, women and children in Gaza are enduring displacement, death, pain, and suffering in a way that the human mind cannot bear. More than 80% are living in tents without the minimum basic needs to live, without water, without food, with a chilling cold. The current situation is pushing them to the limit, making it impossible to focus on anything but survival.
Today, innocent civilians are placed in inhumane conditions which do not possess the most basic requirements for human survival. When it comes to children and women, the suffering becomes more painful because women's needs are greater. Women today live in tents. There is no bathroom. There is no toilet. They cannot take care of themselves. They have to stand in long lines in front of men's bathrooms, and this means double suffering. Also, do not forget pregnant women or those who gave birth during the attack. We're talking about an aggression that affects all vital aspects.
Pregnant women and those who have given birth in the midst of war are one of the most affected groups. Similarly, the United Nations Population Fund estimated that since the beginning of the Israeli aggression on the Gaza Strip, approximately 60,000 women are pregnant, and of them, 5,500 would give birth soon, many of them by cesarean section. This means that terrible hospital sanitary conditions, as well as the food crisis, will endanger their lives and the lives of newborn babies.
Pregnant women are suffering from extreme cold, food shortages and medicine shortages. We have noticed an increase in the rate of spontaneous abortions, an increase in the rate of premature births, and an increase in cases of small fetuses. Pregnant women leave the hospital about 10 hours after giving birth and go to the tents, where they have no means of living. Newborn babies are exposed to many diseases. We have observed that a large percentage of these women return to the hospital with their children who have caught a cold, and some have also died.
The lack of hygiene and high levels of malnutrition experienced in overcrowded refugee camps are a poisonous mixture. According to the World Food Program, there is a high risk of famine, and cases of dehydration and malnutrition are increasing rapidly. Many mothers say they only eat once a day to survive. However, there are children who have stopped talking or eating because of what they have seen and experienced. Others cry and scream with every loud sound they hear. Months of war have traumatized an entire generation of children.
You see the atmosphere. Making bread is suffering. To go to the bathroom, you have to wait in line. To get water and foods, you also have to wait in line. That is, our entire life is suffering. In the tent where I live, there are approximately 8 people and my daughter, her husband, and her daughter as well. That is 13 people in just 9 square meters. We have to make the bread here, you see, and if we don't find cardboard to light the fire, we can't bake the bread. We only have 1 bottle of water a day and food. If they give us help, we eat. And if they don't give us food, no, because the price of goods is multiplied by 10.
The suffering we experience as children is that we have been forced out of our homes. Our houses were bombed when we were inside it. My friend, who was my cousin, has died. All my friends have died, and I have no one left. Our childhood has been stolen from us. I want to go back to my house. I want the war to end and return home so I can rest.
Gazans continue to call for Israel to fulfill its obligations under international humanitarian law, which begins with the protection of civilian lives. They assure that all they want is the end of this nightmare full of death and pain. Palestinian women have always been the symbol of the strong law of resistance. However, displacement, hunger, and lack of health care due to the Zionist war are disproportionately affecting women. They claim that even their dignity has been lost. And for that reason, they will never forget and they will take revenge for these violations and the misery they are in just because of the Zionist regime. Hoda Hejazi, Gaza, Palestine.
In the limelight.
Joe Biden's immense pressure on the Zionist regime to refrain from crossing red lines tells us that the U.S. fully understands that Iran is not bluffing. In